Information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
To border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
I'm doing very well. I can block out the present and the past now. It's episode 106 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 9th, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato, coming to you as always from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. News, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups abound on this episode 106. Ron Paul on fading empires and darker markets. Protests, paranoia, and the persistence of resistance. Plus, Zionazis, prophecies, presidential puppets, and the Masonic inaugural ball. And if we have time on this episode 106, we'll get into media memes and Scientology and Oregon art and more and more. It's January 9th, 2009, episode 106 of MediaMonarchy.com. Something is squeezing my skull. Brand new music from Morrissey. His new record drops in the middle of February. It's called Years of Refusal. And if you've been a listener of the show for any amount of time, you've probably heard me reference Morrissey or the Smiths. And I've been a huge, almost the better part of my life. Been a big Morrissey and Smiths fan. So stoked. And I've listened to that track repeatedly. Listened to the whole record all the way through once. I'm really impressed with it. You never quite know which version of Morrissey you're going to get, whether you're going to get the really dour, orchestral kind of version. However, in this case, I was happy to hear we're getting the rock version of Morrissey. But I won't bore you with my love affair with Britpop. Right now, anyway. Because we got to take care of the business. It's January 9th, 2009, 1909. Episode 106 of MediaMonarchy.com. Like I said, my name's Jimmy Pilato, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and Revere Radio Network, live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, praradio.org, revereradio.net. And of course, thanks to the good folks at KBFR, Boulder, Colorado, 93.9 FM, blasting out LPFM style. And of course, FaceSpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, all that, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. Reach out and touch someone named Media Monarchy. Let me throw out quickly, thanks again, and as always, to the folks who get in touch with me through the site, whether it's author Tim Fleming, or my man Alex in Germany, or last week at the very end of the show, I was done. Nathan Jimenez was already on, and I got a call from Anubis out in Virginia, who'd been listening to the show live on Revere, and he basically asked the question that I don't want to hear is, you can't take phone calls? Unfortunately, no, I can't right now. Still working out, taking phone calls on the air, or how to get... Basically, haven't exactly figured out how to run Skype and run it through the board, and how I interface with talking on Skype and also talking on the air here at our shoestring budget of Portland Radio Authority. But I'm doing very well, and we'll keep doing it. So keep getting in touch. Keep asking me, hey, what's up? Can you take a call? Let's get into it. There's a lot. I am at times speechless. I know that last night, and of course, should always have listened to the previous episode, so yesterday made episode 105, the B-side, MediaMonarchy.com. I find there are more moments where I'm sort of speechless about what's going on in the world. It's in my head, in my thoughts, and they're in my heart, but sometimes I can't get them out of my mouth. So on last night's B-side, we gave the last word to the Honorable Dr. Ron Paul, where he noted, in relation to the Israeli Gaza slaughter still ongoing, and of course, how it relates to the American Empire. So what we closed on last night on 105B was that we're in big, big trouble. Right now, Ron Paul notes that, of course, we spend trillions of dollars to maintain this crumbling American empire.
Barack Obama warning that we could see trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. He's also proposing a stimulus plan that could top $1 trillion. Joining us now from Washington to talk more about all of this is the former presidential candidate, Republican Congressman Ron Paul of Texas. So, Congressman, we know some of the details of this stimulus plan, combination of tax breaks and spending, maybe even tax subsidies for some people who don't earn enough money to make to actually pay income taxes. What do you think of the whole proposal that you, as you know it thus far?
Well, I think it's just more of the same. It's more spending and more debt, and I don't think it'll solve the problem. It's turning the spending responsibilities over to government rather than individuals, and that's not the way you make an economy work. That's what we've been trying to do for years, and we've accelerated that in the last year. And it's just stumbling along. It reminds me of the 1930s, and we're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing this, but it's not going to solve our problem. You know, they say that we're going to have trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. At the same time, we want to be fiscal conservatives and start talking about budgetary reforms. Like, changing the budget is a tactical thing, and it's only a budgetary problem. But to me, it's a philosophic problem. Why are we spending all this money? Why do we run the world empire, and why do we have a welfare state? And how did we get ourselves into this mess, and how did we allow this monetary system to do this to us? But we cannot solve our problem by doing exactly the same thing that got us into this mess.
This idea, Congressman Paul, $1 trillion deficits for years to come, it's almost like trillion has become the new billion. And if you say it quickly, maybe it doesn't hurt so much, but just how much pain could this leave for our children and grandchildren?
Well, you know, we talk about that a lot, and we should, but I'm afraid that this generation is going to suffer, because I think the confidence eventually will be lost. You know, if $2 trillion a year budget doesn't seem to quite work, and that's the tactic, why not have a $4 trillion? Eventually, the confidence will be lost. It'll be lost in the system. The financial system broke down because they lost confidence in it, because it was built on illusions. But soon, they're going to lose confidence in the dollar. Now, that'll be a crisis that'll be much bigger than the crisis we're facing today.
So if you were the president's chief economic advisor, or you were running the budget office, what would you do?
I would balance the budget, and I would tell people to save their money, and that we should cut spending. But where we would cut spending is not domestic. We spend over $1 trillion a year maintaining our world empire. We can afford to do less overseas, because what we do overseas just causes problems for us. The Soviet system came down because they overextended themselves in Afghanistan. They bankrupted that country. And actually, Osama bin Laden said, I'm going to bankrupt the Soviets, and they'll have to leave, and they did. Right. And we're doing the same thing.
So
we're too extended. We could cut, balance the budget, cut spending, and let the people go back to work, go to savings, and let the market operate.
So, Dr. Paul, you obviously know a lot about economics, you know a lot about finance, but noted and Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman has said, we need to have a stimulus package. It needs to be a big stimulus package, and we need to have it quickly.
Well, yeah, he comes from a different view, but I doubt if he ever read Austrian economics. I don't even know if he knows who Mises is and Hayek and Rothbard, the people who talked about free market. He's not a free market person. Matter of fact, we haven't had free market policies in this country for a long, long time, because once you have a Federal Reserve system, they are the central economic planners. They manipulate the economy by artificially lowering interest rates. So the economists you hear from in our universities and in from Washington, D.C. are all interventionists. They're liberals. They're Keynesians. So if they're still winning the Nobel Prize for economics, then we're in serious trouble. But fortunately for us, there are a lot more people in this country who are waking up to the fact that the culprit is really the Federal Reserve, the monetary system, and this spendthrift Congress that we have and government. And once that's realized and we have enough people, it will change, because we can't continue to do what we're doing now. Well, something has to give.
Yeah, there's no question that this idea of running multi-year trillion-dollar deficits is more than just a little shocking. Congressman Ron Paul, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming in this morning. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Something's got to give. Now, whether you listen to Ron Paul and follow sort of Austrian economics and Ludwig von Mises and that free market crew, or Webster Tarpley, who says that there's never been a free market, Austrian economics is just as damaging, they will both agree on the abolition of the Federal Reserve, and that our monetary system is the fundamental problem. So we may not be able to agree on exactly where we would go, but we can agree on what the problems are, the causes of these booms and busts that, of course, the phony Federal Reserve was, of course, set up to supposedly avoid. So that was Ron Paul on CNN by way of raw replay. U.S. spends $1 trillion to maintain its empire. That segues nicely, so we're going to stay on the econo crash tip. Execs, tycoons, darker markets, and the porn bailout. I'll save the porn for last. First, from the Washington Post, manufacturing falls to a 28-year low. U.S. manufacturing activity decreased in December at its fastest pace in nearly 30 years as businesses cut production and slashed product orders in response to the global recession, according to a closely watched survey. Said survey is... survey says the Institute for Supply Management Index of Industrial Production, and I have a link to you, link with goes through all that. The Institute for Supply Management's Index of Industrial Production slipped from 36.2 to 32.4 in December, the lowest level since June 1980. A reading above 50 indicates that manufacturing activity is expanding, while a reading below 50 indicates a contraction. None of the industries covered in the survey reported an expansion in their business, and the drop registered not just in the Institute's index, but also in the volume of new orders and raw material costs. Quote, "We're looking around for evidence not of things turning up, but that things are not going down as rapidly. And at the moment, we can't find any evidence," says Nigel Gault, G-A-U-L-T, chief U.S. economist for Global Insight. Things are falling very fast. And again, as Webster Tarpley notes, the banksters get whatever they want. They get the bailout handed to them, and they can do whatever they want with it. Of course, we've hit the articles. We don't know where the bailout money went. What, you want us to keep track of it? However, the automakers say about them what you will, they had to beg for it. You're gonna fucking beg. Why? Because they actually create things that, you know, people would want to buy, which we don't do in this country anymore because there's been the systematic process of destroying actual goods and services. We are a service economy. And I wear my name tag proudly. If we jump to Iran, PressTV.ir, U.S. 2008 job losses at a 63-year high. The U.S. job losses in 2008 reached the highest level since the end of World War II. A Labor Department report is expected to show, and I believe that's supposed to be today. So we'll try and hit up Google News and confirm that job losses are at a 63-year high. Payrolls fell 500,000 in December, bringing last year's total job losses to 2.4 mil, the most since 1945. This according to a poll of analysts surveyed by Bloomberg, with a link. The Labor Department figures due today, January 9th, 2009, are also expected to show unemployment rate rising to its highest level since 1993. The jobless rate probably climbed to 7% in December from 6.7% the prior month, again according to the Bloomberg survey. U.S. President-elect Barack Obama warned on Saturday of double-digit unemployment should a swift action not be taken to tackle the financial crisis. And Ron Paul just noted, that it will be more of the same. That swift action, let's do more of the same. A nice headline from the Wall Street Journal again, and we'll point it out numerous times in this episode. That thing that doesn't exist, and if you say it does, you're a kook, but it's good. The New World Order. Wall Street Journal, article title, "Foundation of New World Order is Uncertainty." And maybe that's the change we're all getting. CNS News noted, actually back, I believe, in December, but my man Doug rescued it from the memory hole and put it up recently in this last week. Bailout cost exceeds all American wars. The total value of the bailouts, if you want to use that fraudulent term, the total value of the bailouts undertaken by the federal government in 2008 now exceeds the combined cost of every major war the United States has ever engaged in, according to a comparison of war costs calculated by the Congressional Research Office and the value of bailouts as calculated by Bloomberg News, again, or Bianco Research. According to Congressional Research Service, all major U.S. wars, including such events as the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, but not the invasion of Panama or the Kosovo War, cost a total of $7.2 trillion in inflation-adjusted 2008 dollars. According to Bloomberg, the federal government has made commitments worth a total of $8.5 trillion in the bailouts of 2008. That includes actual expenditures as well as loan and asset guarantees. Bianco Research puts the total value of the bailouts at $8.7 trillion. More than every fraudulent, phony humanitarian intervention war we've ever engaged in. As we now look at the effects of some of these causes, sometimes the effect is suicide. My favorite photo from the bailout hoopla of September, October of last year was someone at one of the Wall Street protests that had a sign that said, "Jump, you fuckers!" German tycoon Adolf Merkel commits suicide. This from Reuters out of the UK. German billionaire Adolf Merkel, that's M-E-R-C-K-L-E, that's not spelled the same as German Chancellor, President, Selectee, Head, Angela Merkel. So don't believe they're related. German billionaire Adolf Merkel has committed suicide in despair over the huge losses suffered by his business empire during the financial crisis, his family said last Tuesday. The media-shy billionaire, whose family controls some of Germany's best-known companies, was hit by a train on Monday evening. The desperate situation of his companies caused by the financial crisis, the uncertainties of the last few weeks, and his powerlessness to act have broken the passionate family entrepreneur and took his own life. That said, from a family statement, state prosecutors from the southern city of Ulm, said Merkel, 74, left work on Monday and died after being hit by a train near the town of Blaubrunn. He left behind a suicide note to his family. There was no sign of anyone else being involved. From the Washington Examiner, DCExaminer.com, DC Metro execs threaten service cuts, but then hike their own pay. Metro, of course, being the transportation system in Washington, D.C., somewhat similar to our MAX and TriMet system here in Portland. As its financial situation worsens, the Washington Area Metropolitan Transit Authority, Metro, is threatening major service cuts and perhaps even some layoffs. And I link you to their press release on the DC Metro website. But one steadily growing budget item seems particularly impervious to belt tightening, and that would be employee compensation, particularly in the executive suite. Metro's approved fiscal 2009 annual budget includes large pay hikes for salaried management employees, as well as hourly workers such as bus drivers, rail operators, and maintenance workers, fortunately. But the numbers take on added significance when compared to the previous years. However, jumping down to the bottom, meanwhile, through all this wrangling and haggling and threats, oh, we're going to have to cut some service, but good old boy still gets his pay increase. Meanwhile, Metro's customers, as if they have a choice, Metro's customers have to contend with broken escalators, defective subway cars, increasing crime, and decreasing system reliability, even as they continue to pay higher fares and parking fees imposed on them last year when most Metro employees were getting yet another raise. Isn't this the same kind of pay yourself first, no matter what mentality that nailed Detroit and Wall Street? Of course it is. Lastly, on this econo crash, execs, tycoons, darker markets, and the porn bailout. This from CNN, and of course it got lots of coverage even on trash sites like Perez Hilton. Is that what it is? Porn industry seeks federal bailout. And there's a nice photo of Larry Flint and the Joe Francis Girls Gone Wild guy, and they both have goofy oh looks on their faces, so I posted that up for you. Another major American industry is asking for assistance as the global financial crisis continues. Hustler publisher Larry Flint and Girls Gone Wild CEO Joe Francis said Wednesday they will request that Congress allocate $5 billion for the bailout of the adult entertainment industry. The take here is that everyone and their mother want to be bailed out from the banks to the big three, said Owen Mugen, spokesman for Larry Flint. The porn industry has been hurt by the downturn like everyone else, and they're going to ask for the $5 billion. Is it the most serious thing in the world? Is it going to make the lives of Americans better if it happens? It's not for them to determine. Francis said in a statement that, quote, the U.S. government should actively support the adult industry's survival and growth, just as it feels the need to support any other industry cherished by the American people. Larry Flint and Joe Francis want to bail out too, which, of course, everyone's saying. And again, signs, protest signs, asking, where's my bailout? You're not a bankster. So, say what you will about Hustler and Larry Flynt. Larry Flynt, at least, always being a rabid advocate of the First Amendment and outing hypocritical politicians. Joe Francis of Girls Gone Wild, I believe, is probably a date rape jackass. So, I may not believe in what you have to say, but we'll fight to the death for your right to say it. But I'm not saying this should be bailed out. Just some food for thought. Just some porn for thought. Now, this is an interesting one. This initially was just a funny posting that I got from Threat Level. It's the new 2009 counterterrorism calendar. Terror, anthrax, and more in the free, downloadable counterterrorism calendar for 2009. If you have not purchased a 2009 calendar or day planner yet, we suggest the National Counterterrorism Center calendar from the Department of Justice. No need to spring for the latest hottie pinup or teddy bear calendar planner. This one, downloadable and free of charge, and it's only 63 megs for you to download. Linked up for you. Shows mugs of dozens of America's most wanted terror suspects. But that's not all. The 160th page planner contains data on known terrorist groups, individual terrorists, and technical information on topics such as biological and chemical threats and explosives. The 2009 edition contains more counterterrorism information than any previous edition, as well as the most comprehensive index to date, making it easier for first responders to find the information they need about everything from anthrax to VBE IDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices. The calendar includes key U.S. Christian, Islamic, and Jewish holidays as well. Each day also shows both the Gregorian date and the equivalent on the Islamic calendar, so you don't plan an ill-timed vacation to the Middle East. And it's all available to the public. Act now and we'll double your order. So that little tongue-in-cheek shilling from Threat Level over on Wired.com. So it was funny. And I downloaded the calendar and posted it up. There you go. So I get a comment from, of course, Anonymous. Says, actually, the calendar's not produced by the Justice Department. It's produced by the National Counterterrorism Center, which is part of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. To which I initially thought, well, okay, you should probably tell that to Threat Level, because that's where I got the story from. Then, as I was going through the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com. As I track through StatCounter.com, I like to see who's visiting. And, of course, at the end of every episode, we go over the most interesting Google hits that MediaMonarchy.com has received. I noticed something that kind of synced up. 1 minute after the comment had been timestamped and placed on this counterterrorism calendar posting, I noticed I had a hit from the CIA in Fairfax, Virginia. So I reposted up their ISP and their date and their timestamp that basically shows that thanks, CIA, for anonymously leaving a comment on a website and setting us straight about who put out this bullshit threataganda counterterrorism calendar. So, thanks, CIA. They're commenting on the website, so at least they're not trying to, flame war and troll, which I believe we're going to get into. You know that paid military operatives are out trolling around on the web. Flame war. Is that how you want your tax dollars to be spent? We're going to move now to Police State International, and one that I'm sure I need to actually open up Google News and see what's going on right now on this Friday morning, January 9th, 2009. We've got Police State International, protests, paranoia, and the persistence of resistance. First, police execute unarmed man in public, and they shot him in the back. You know of this story. It's happening in Oakland, California. It's setting the city almost literally on fire. This from Mercury News. A BART police officer struggling to handcuff a 22-year-old man, stood up over the face-down Hayward resident and fired a single shot into his back while a handful of officers watched. A video taken by a train passenger apparently shows all this. No apparently about it. It shows it all. The attorney for the family of Oscar Grant III, fatally shot by a then-unidentified BART officer early New Year's Day, said Sunday he plans to file a $25 million lawsuit against the department and ask prosecutors to consider filing murder charges against the murderous officer.
An attorney representing the family of a young Hayward man who was fatally shot by a BART police officer says he plans to file a $25 million lawsuit against the transit agency. During a news conference today, exclusive video obtained by KTVU was mentioned several times. The footage shows the actual shooting early New Year's Day and could play a key role in the case. We want to warn viewers the video is graphic and some may want to turn away. KTVU's Sergio Quintana was at the news conference today. He's live in the newsroom with the details. Sergio?
Well, this was a very emotional news conference that included Oscar Grant's family and friends. Some of them were there with Grant the night he was shot.
A room full of Oscar Grant's family and friends solemnly filed into the cramped conference room of Oakland attorney John Burris. Based on the video he has seen and witness accounts, Burris said he will be filing a $25 million wrongful death claim, a civil rights lawsuit, and he wants the district attorney to file criminal charges against the police officer who pulled the trigger.
It is, without a doubt, the most unconscionable shooting I have seen ever.
This is the video you will only see on KTVU. It was captured by a passenger aboard the BART train with a cell phone who does not want to be identified. You can see Oscar Grant on his knees here talking to police. Then he is pulled down onto the ground face down. There is what seems to be a struggle. Then a second BART police officer puts his knee to Grant's neck and head. The video graphically displays what happens the moment Grant is shot. One officer pulls at his gun. He stands, unholsters the gun, and fires. Just feet from where Grant was shot, his friend Fernando Anisete.
I couldn't believe it. We was already following directions and everything, and they shot him.
With pictures and lots of tears, Grant's family described a young man who often was a peacemaker and a role model.
In these last 8 months to a year, I watched my nephew become a better man. I don't know if this was a premonition that he was going to leave us.
Several aunts and uncles spoke on behalf of Grant's mother, Wanda. Lita Mesa spoke on behalf of Grant's girlfriend, Sofina, and mother of their 4-year-old daughter, Tatiana.
Her father is not going to be there to see her go to kindergarten. He is not going to be there for her prom, for her wedding. She was robbed of that.
Attorney John Burris said he does not believe the shooting was racially motivated, but he does question why deadly force would be used when another officer was holding Grant on the floor.
Given what was transpiring, there really wasn't any need to have a firearm out.
Oakland turns violent over shooting. This from the New York Times. Protesters angry over a deadly New Year's Day shooting of a young black man by a transit police officer erupted into violence in downtown Oakland on Wednesday night while investigators struggled to determine what prompted the officer to fire his gun into the unarmed man's back. The last update that I have posted up, and I didn't see anything immediately on Google News just now. The bastard has a name-o now. Officer Johannes Maserl. And I'm sure I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly. First name, Johannes Maserle. Johann Maserl resigns over his murderous actions. I worry that, again, of course, things like this, as we always cover, the bad cop news, is that just going to make those gangsters compact more into their gang think? And probably yes. And I've said, but of course have not lived up to that, that, okay, well, every time we make some mention of murderous bastard cops, we should make a mention of something good and heroic and upstanding. But there has to be accountability. So I'm not going to avoid stories like this just because, well, I don't want to heap more stuff on the cops. Bad is bad, and truth will out. Next from Raw Story, and also Threat Level a couple of airport security scare annoya stories. First, Muslim family says that paranoid people got us booted from the plane. Nine Muslims, including three children, were ordered off a domestic U.S. flight after two other passengers heard them making what they thought were suspicious remarks about security.
A Muslim family is looking for answers after an airline apparently kicked them off a flight. The nine Muslim passengers included three children who were heading from D.C. to a religious retreat in Florida when other passengers on the AirTran flight apparently became worried about a conversation they overheard about the safest place to sit. When the FBI gave them the all clear, the airline did not let them back on the plane. Joining us now for an exclusive interview from Orlando, Kashif and Atif Ifran, who are brothers who were banned from that flight. Now, I'd just like to ask either of you, from the statement we've gotten from AirTran here, they seem to be putting it on TSA, and part of what they say is at departure time, the captain of the flight, 175, informed the airline there were two federal marshals on board who contacted local law enforcement about a security issue. So, what I want to ask you is, did you get the sense that it was air marshals on the plane that kicked this whole thing off and not necessarily the airline?
Well, I think for the most part, the marshals and the federal agents that we dealt with were actually pretty kind and pretty generous in how they dealt with us. I think more so the blame falls on the airline simply because I believe from what we were told that they initiated the action, that the stewardesses were told by some of the people on the plane, I think it was two young girls, that something was going on, and then they initiated by talking to the captain. And I believe from what the federal agents told us again was that it was the captain's final decision whether or not to let us on the plane or not. So.
And what was this conversation that was going on that someone overheard that got the ball rolling?
Well, basically, my wife and I and my sister-in-law, as we're walking into the plane, we're discussing, you know, normally where we would sit near the wings or in the center of the plane because I've always been told it's the safest place to sit. So we were just discussing the safest place in case of something happening to the plane, where we would, you know, what's the best place to sit? Should we sit by the wings? Should we sit in the back of the plane? In doing that discussion, we were very careful not to use any of the what you call keywords or buzzwords like bomb or terrorist or threat or anything that would allude to us doing anything or being in a situation that would be volatile. And unfortunately, someone gleaned from that, you know, we're planning on taking over the plane or God knows what they thought.
It's interesting to think I've never been able to pick where I wanted to sit on the plane. Usually those things are assigned. However, maybe AirTran is actually just a small little puddle jumper and you get on and there's only 20 people. Which probably made it even more of a compacted little paranoid situation. You can hit some of the updates there, and there are actually more videos and links to the Washington Post and others. But the other airport security hoax, paranoia, threat again, call it what you will, airplane cigarette break breaks into in-air brawl. You know all those warnings not to smoke in the airplane lavatory? Delta-owned Comair takes that very seriously. When a flight attendant caught a passenger lighting up on a November flight from New York to Savannah, the pilot diverted to Raleigh to have the nicotic removed from the plane. The passenger, Henry McDowell Jr., had already drawn the ire of his fellow travelers by being loud and aggressive before the flight, according to a downloadable PDF of an FBI affidavit about Henry McDowell Jr., and also that he was grumbling that the, quote, airplane sucks. So when the plane changed course, the other passengers blamed McDowell. That's when things devolved into a flying cage match. McDowell was charged this week with interfering with a flight crew. Threat level notes that they'd have just let the guy smoke. Hear, hear. If we jump to Metro West and Framingham and banks and microchipping and fingerprinting, Massachusetts Bank requires fingerprint to cash a check. Ariel Sarusi, S-A-R-O-U-S-I. Ariel Sarusi felt surprised and dismayed when asked to provide a fingerprint to cash a check at a Framingham, Massachusetts Bank of America branch on Monday. The 25-year-old Framingham native who lives in Virginia brought a rent check to the Bank of America branch on Beacon Street. He does not have a bank account with the bank, but the check came from a Bank of America account. They asked for an ID, which I provided, and after that, they brought an ink pad. I asked why, and they said they wanted to take a fingerprint. I said, get out, please. And they said, no, we're serious. Cerusi said he had other forms of ID, and that should be enough to cash a check. I said, you can't expect me to provide fingerprints to cash a check. I took my check and left. And that's what we all will have to do. A quick one. It's a video, but I'm not going to play the clip for you. Cell phones can and are being used as bugs. This from nearingmidnight.com. Cell phones are being used as bugs, taps, tracking, spying. Dr. Alfred Adams, author of the books, available over at nearingmidnight.com, put together some clips about how it works and possibly what you can do to stop it. We have noted, of course, that your cell phone can track you even when you turn it off. That sometimes the only way to fix it, even if that's effective, is actually removing the battery. If you recall the BBC show we went over many moons ago here on MediaMonarchy.com, Suspect Nation, where a guy was tracked and traced, and actually if you go through this clip, you'll see how a local news guy said, oh, okay, track my phone, and we hear then the tracked and the conversations that all get captured. But let's jump across the pond to the UK, to Leeds, from the BBC, from the Big Brother Corporation. UK police placed in all city schools. Every secondary school in Leeds is to have a dedicated police officer as part of a drive to cut crime. 8 of the city's 38 schools will have a full-time police presence. Another 16 officers will cover the remaining 30 schools. More than 250 offenses were committed in Leeds schools during 2008, figures show. Although officers will be able to arrest and search pupils, West Yorkshire police stressed they would focus on education, not enforcement. The 24 officers involved in the project will support lessons on weapons and drugs awareness, citizenship, and personal safety, as well as tackling issues like bullying, absenteeism, and truancy. So the men in black ski masks in your school in the UK, they're there to help you and train you to not worry. You will love your servitude. Or here in the U.S., we've got the combat brigades, and they'll come out and do nice PR stunts and use the jaws of life, but they're practicing to take over your cities. I don't know how to put it any more simply than that. CNN, of course, notes that the FBI wants 850 new agents, despite a bleak economic environment featuring wide-ranging layoffs and rising unemployment. The nation's premier law enforcement agency is touting, quote, one of the largest hiring blitzes in our 100-year history. You can link over to FBI.gov and read about their hiring blitz, and maybe you can even apply to be a new FBI agent. God knows we're going to have to enforce the new carbon taxes and GPS mileage taxes. And moving to Greece. This from Paul Joseph Watson. And of course, we've noted the chaos in Greece. The Greek syndrome, it was called, if you'll remember from last week. But now, CIA preparing to install military government in Greece? The increasingly violent riots in Greece could be the curtain raiser for a military coup d'etat and the installation of a new government more friendly to U.S. hegemony as a countermeasure to increasing Russian influence over the Balkan state. It wouldn't be the first time the CIA has assisted in such a venture. They aided the 1967 installation of a U.S.-friendly military junta known as the Regime of the Colonels, ostensibly to prevent Greece from falling under Soviet control, a fascist cabal which was later overthrown in 1973, the Regime of the Colonels, the fascist regime later overthrown in 73. The coup was achieved with the active support of such groups as the LOK Special Forces, which of course was part of Operation Gladio, NATO-controlled black op forces that carried out false flag attacks across Europe to eliminate left-wing political organizations. So call it COINTELPRO or Operation Gladio. We know the score. Gladio tactics are again being employed with the current riots following the revelation that police masquerading as anarchists were committing acts of wanton violence to inflame tensions and provide a pretext for a brutal crackdown on legitimate demonstrators protesting against police brutality and the mishandling of the economic crisis. The agenda is again likely to be related to fears over increasing Russian influence in this region. It's all right there, and you can see it coming together. The game now is with Brzezinski and the Trilateral Boys and Barry Obama carrying the football. The baton is being passed. We, of course, had all the ex-puppets meeting in the White House yesterday. We'll get to that. We're now switching into Soviet paranoia and, of course, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and, of course, the police carrying out false flag attacks to demonize protesters because, you know, maybe you don't like when your 22-year-old brother gets shot in the back by the cops, or maybe you don't like when the ATM doesn't give any money. We need to look at Greece and Iceland and other places very closely because it may be the portent. There's great related research articles posted up in conjunction with this, such as violent attacks erupt in Greece, Greece-style riots coming to U.S., U.S. spy ship leaves Sevastopol for Greece, banks and cars burned by Greek mob, Greece violence targets police, U.K. government preparing extra graves for pandemic, neocons still preparing for Iran attack, Russian combat aircraft to join military drills with Belarus, and are the Greek riots a taste of things to come? Returning to the North American Union, if we take off to the Great White North, by way of the Associated Press, U.S. soldier ordered to leave Canada. I don't constantly follow some of the war resistors, conscientious objectors, AWOL pussy deserters that are up in Canada. I know we've covered Joshua Key and even guys like Aaron Watada. But here, the first woman soldier to flee the U.S. military for Canada to avoid the Iraq War has been ordered deported along with her husband and children. Kimberly Rivera said Wednesday her requests to stay on humanitarian and compassionate grounds were rejected. Rivera served in Iraq in 2006 and came to Canada the following year after she refused redeployment. She lives in Toronto with her husband and three kids. The youngest is 6 weeks old and Canadian-born. Kim Rivera says she'll discuss her options with her husband and supporters, but feels she's come to the end of the road. The family must leave Canada by January 27th unless the order is reversed. The group War Resisters Support Campaign says four other resistors and their families face deportation in January alone. War Resisters Support Campaign is at resistors.ca. There's also more from The Telegraph as well as Courage2Resist.org, where they recently had a little interview with Kimberly Rivera.
This is Courage to Resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refuse to fight. Kimberly Rivera is a wife and the mother of two small children. She is also a GI resistor. After serving 3 troubling months in Iraq, Kimberly came home on leave and made the life-changing decision not to return to the war. She and her family drove to Canada, where she is seeking refugee status. She is speaking to us on the phone today from her home in Toronto. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you have quite a story to tell, including the fact that you served 2 separate stints in the U.S. Army. Why don't you begin by telling us how you got yourself into the Army 2 different times?
It's kind of funny, actually. Well, for me, anyway. Well, as most people know, the recruiters start out on you at a very early age in high school, and sometimes they will approach you even at 16 because it's really hard to tell the ages of the kids in high school And it's like once they find out you're not 16 or you're not a junior or senior, they have nothing to do with you. They won't speak to you the rest of the year. But the next year comes when they get your roster from school, they start calling your home, they start setting up the tables again in the lunchroom, and continuing to just do their spill on you over and over and over. And as a high school student, you're not really prepared, I guess, to make a life-changing decision, and that's what the military is. But I made that decision, and sometimes I feel maybe I was a little forced to do it, being that I was I lived at home with my mom and dad still, because I'm in high school, and I never wanted to be a burden on them. So I thought, you know, this would be the best way that I can take care of my money for school. But also, I just basically had to sit down with the recruiters at my home after they had called me like several times, and I finally talked to them, realizing that they're not going to stop calling until I talk with them.
That's Kimberly Rivera, and that's an interview from CourageToResist.org. Of course, that's about a 20-minute interview, and that's just a little taste for you. Getting on the internet, more evidence of Pentagon war against the internet. This from Kurt Nemo over at truthnews.us. Further evidence has emerged revealing how the Pentagon is in the business of responding to blog posts critical of the U.S. government. That sounds familiar. Noah Shachman, of course, the lead editor for Danger Room, writing for Wired, posts an Air Force flowchart used for counter-blogging purposes. Quote, in a 12-point plan put together by the Emerging Technology Division of the Air Force's Public Affairs Arm, airmen are given guidance on how to handle trolls and ragers, and even well-informed online writers, too. It's all part of an Air Force push to counter the people out there in the blogosphere who have negative opinions about the U.S. government and the Air Force, said Captain David Faggard. F-A-G-G-A-R-D. In the case of sites like InfoWars and Prison Planet, for whom Kurt Nemo writes, CENTCOM operatives do not respond to trolls and ragers. In fact, many of them seem to be the most vociferous trolls and ragers. On October 16, 2006, Raw Story reported that the United States Central Command, CENTCOM, sent an email to bloggers on the subject of the GWAT, or so-called Global War on Terror, as part of the Pentagon's, quote, engagement operations. The military engaging me on my blog. So, in the case we just went over on the counterterrorism calendar, a small point of which alphabet agency put out this stupid fucking calendar. But we'll see where it goes. Driving down the NAFTA superhighway is going to happen one way or the other. So they came out and said, oh, the NAFTA superhighway, the Trans-Texas corridor, it's dead. It's just over. The people don't want it, so we're just going to stop. But of course, the Trans-Texas corridor and the NAFTA superhighway are dead in name only. We've got the Austin American Statesman as well as the Houston Chronicle. The Trans-Texas Corridor, as a name and as a guiding concept of the state's transportation future, is dead, Texas Department of Transportation Executive Director Amedeo Sins told an audience of more than 1,000 people last Tuesday at an Austin hotel. But Sains acknowledged that all elements of the original plan, including a tollway twin to Interstate 35, could be built as standalone projects if and when they're deemed necessary. Governor Rick Slick Perry in 2002 unveiled with great fanfare the corridor plan as an almost $2 billion blueprint for the state's transportation future, and then took withering criticism for it in a tough 2006 re-election race. On Tuesday, he said, quote, the days of the Trans-Texas corridor are over. Insert joke about bridge for sale here. So it's dead in that name. Oh, we don't have Echelon anymore. We don't have Total Information Awareness anymore. It's dead. It'll pop up as something else. Lastly, on this Police State International heading, protests, paranoia, and the persistence of resistance from the AFP. Army sends Dear John Doe letter to families of war dead. The U.S. Army apologized Wednesday for mistakenly sending 7,000 letters to families of soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan with the salutation, Dear John Doe. The letter, which was mailed December 20th, contained information about private organizations offering assistance to families who lost a soldier, but omitted specific names and addresses. The salutation says, Dear John Doe, which was basically sort of a placeholder where the name of the individual or the recipient was supposed to be, said Paul Boyce, an Army spokesman. Boyce said the error was not caught when the 7,000 letters were printed, sorted, and sent out to family members. And there are links there, and you can read about the whoops and the old sorry. And I think the latest update that I have bookmarked but not posted up yet is that basically whoever is responsible is keeping quiet and we don't know who did it. However, that seems fairly inconsequential in a way. As we move into the second week of Israeli slaughter in the Gaza Strip, the ground assault has now begun. I have, of course, tons of links about this. There's no way I can cover it all. Nor sometimes can I claim that I understand fully all the minutiae and intricacies. All I know is that the borders that were given to Israel in 1967 have somehow expanded over the last 40 years. At the cost of millions of lives. So there are, of course, brutal videos and clips and links and photos and things for you. But, of course, let's go right back to those who know things about war and death, Danger Room. Ground war in Gaza begins. The ground war, this actually going back to, I believe, Monday. The ground war has begun. After 8 days of airstrikes, Israeli troops moving into Gaza. The IDF, Israel Defense Forces, say, quote, infantry tanks, engineering forces, artillery, and intelligence, along with support of the Israel Air Force, Israel Navy, Security Agency, and other agencies, are all participating in the push. Tens of thousands of reservists are now being called up. The campaign won't be easy and it won't be short, Barak says. That would be their Barak, not our Barak. He ain't saying shit about this. Already, there's been a heavy exchange of fire between Israeli forces and Hamas militants, Haaretz reports. Israeli artillery has started to fall in Gaza. Leaflets signed by the commander of the Israeli military were dropped over northern Gaza on Saturday morning, warning residents to leave the area immediately. The week-plus-long air war killed nearly 450 and wounded another 2,000-plus. I'm sure those are conservative numbers, especially at this point. Not to mention the time of the writing of this. The house-to-house fighting that lies ahead could be much deadlier, and questions still linger about what the Gaza strikes are designed to accomplish, really. The IDF says the ground assault's objective is to, quote, destroy the terrorist infrastructure of Hamas in the precise area of operation while taking control of some of the rocket-launching area used by the Hamas in order to greatly reduce the quantity of rockets fired at Israel and Israeli civilians. But Israeli politicians are making noises about the need to reach a situation in which we do not allow Hamas to govern. We note, of course, from the Washington Post, and I should note tons of links in that story to hit up the New York Times and CNN and on and on. Israel launches fresh attacks in seventh day of fighting. I liked that headline from the Washington Post. As I noted, they should have probably rested on the seventh day. Again, from Kurt Nimmo, Israel sends ground troops into Gaza, this being now the sort of second wave and second move. You know, any pussy can lob some missiles and mortars at people, but now we're going to put some fucking boots on the ground. Hooah! Last Saturday, Israel graduated from its murderous bombing raids on Gaza to sending soldiers into the lockdown territory. Quote, for the first time since the start of Operation Cast Lead, IDF ground troops entered the Gaza Strip on Saturday evening, exchanging fire with Hamas gunmen, reports the Jerusalem Post. The IDF said that a large amount of troops from the Armored Corps, Engineering Corps, and Infantry Corps entered the territory with the purpose of destroying Hamas infrastructure. The IDF warned that terrorists using civilians as human shields would bear full responsibility for their fate. There is a video there of Israel sending ground troops into Gaza. Again, Gaza rockets put Israel's nuclear plant in a battle zone. That, of course, being the Dimona nuclear plant. Moving to the Deutsche Press Agency, Israelis leave voicemail messages before they bomb buildings. Isn't that a civil war? Oh, pardon me. The Israeli army's launched roof-knocking operations by which the occupants of the buildings in Gaza they're about to fucking bomb are warned beforehand. Warnings issued by telephone, voicemail, or SMS were intended as a means of limiting civilian casualties in the conflict, Haaretz reported. Civilians were given 10 minutes to leave the premises. An Israeli army spokesman declined to confirm the reports or respond to questions about such tactics being used in its ongoing confrontation with the Palestinian militants. In some cases, advance warnings are given to reduce the number of victims, he said, the Israeli army spokesman. The Israeli army apparently used roof knocking in its killing of senior Hamas official Nizar Rayan on Thursday, Haaretz reported. His family had received warning that the building was about to be attacked, but they had decided to remain inside. Of course, hit up globalresearch.ca. Operation Cast Lead, part of a broader Israeli military intelligence agenda. I believe the author of that article, Michelle Chosadovsky, was, I believe, on Alex Jones' show the other day, talking, of course, about this didn't just erupt, this didn't just happen because somebody was murdered or somebody incurred in my territory. They'd been planning this for months. It was called Operation Cast Lead. War games, terror drills. They don't do them for fun. But let's ask the question, and McClatchy News does it. What helped the rise of Hamas? U.S.-Israel policies, of course. In August 2005, when Israel unilaterally withdrew from the narrow coastal territory, then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon promised it would make Israel safer. Condi Rice hailed the move as historic. Israel had left behind a political vacuum, however. That, along with decisions by Israel, the U.S., and Palestinian rivals, inadvertently boosted the militant Islamic group Hamas into power. Hamas is stronger than ever, and Israel's airstrikes risk bolstering it further, according to current and former U.S. officials, diplomats, and analysts. A side note, of course, is that, in fact, Hamas is part of a larger intelligence operation spawned from the Muslim Brotherhood, long ago compromised by British intel and the CIA. Israel, quote, aided Hamas directly. The Israelis wanted to use it as a counterbalance to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, said Tony Cordesman, Middle East analyst for the Center for Strategic Studies, telling UPI in 2002. Of course, the original report from UPI has found its way down the memory hole. Fortunately, KBOO, KBOO.FM, out of Portland, Oregon, they had a great interview. The audio is linked up. I didn't have time to edit it and get a clip for you. However, the American dream is about to become a nightmare. This from KBOO.FM. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the late 1980s, it took just about everybody by surprise. Pundits in the U.S. said it was proof of the superiority of the capitalist system, but people in other parts of the world wondered whether the U.S. could suffer the same fate. Dmitry Orlov, O-R-L-O-V, believes that the American dream is about to become a nightmare, and he examines the similarities and differences between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in his book, Reinventing Collapse. Link to the book and, of course, the audio there for you to stream or download. Again, I didn't know it was the Soviet Union. I thought it was Russia. Watch the term Soviet Union and the Soviets creep back in to the public consciousness. Let's see how long it takes Barry to mention it. I should mention quickly that we're now into hour number two of episode 106 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and the show. It's January 9th, 2009, of course, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net, live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time and 1 p.m. Eastern Time. 2 hours of news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. We now return to our program. From Foreign Policy Journal, top five lies about Israel's assault on Gaza. I can't go through all this. Let's just hit the list of lies from Jeffrey Hammond at Foreign Policy Journal. Number one, Israel's only targeting legitimate military sites and is seeking to protect innocent lives. Israel never targets civilians. Number two, Hamas violated a ceasefire. The Israeli bombardment is a response to Palestinian rocket fire and is designed to end such rocket attacks. Lie number three, Hamas is using human shields, a war crime. Lie number four, Arab nations have not condemned Israel's actions because they understand Israel's justification for its assault. And finally, the fifth lie, Israel's not responsible for civilian deaths because it warned the Palestinians of Gaza to flee areas that might be targeted. An article and a video. Again, you're going to have to check it yourself. Can't play the clip right now. But of course, U.S. weapons are the ones helping to kill innocent civilians in Gaza. As Israeli warplanes continue to bomb Gaza, attention is turning to the role of American-made weapons in the deadly attacks, which have now killed, of course, over hundreds and wounded over thousands. CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr believes that Israel's use of American weapons against civilians is becoming very problematic. She notes, for example, that the 2,000-pound bomb which killed Hamas leader and members of his family on Thursday, quote, is part of the billions of dollars that Israel has spent buying weapons from the United States. But editor and publisher.com notes that U.S. media coverage of Gaza invasion largely biased towards Israel. Israel launched its much-anticipated invasion of Gaza last Saturday. For over a week, U.S. media had provided largely a one-sided coverage of the conflict with little editorializing or commentary, arguing against border, or rather broader, Israeli actions. Most notably, after more than 8 days of Israeli bombing and Hamas rocket launching in Gaza, the New York Times had produced exactly one editorial. Not a single commentary by any of its columnists, and only two op-eds, one already published elsewhere. The editorial, several days ago, did argue against the wisdom of a ground invasion, but even though that invasion had become ever more likely all week, the paper did not return to the subject. Amazingly, the papers kept its silence going in Sunday's and even Monday's paper with no editorial or columnist comment on the Israeli invasion, beyond, of course, a hawkish pro-invasion contribution by neocon Trotskyite William Kristol. It's as if the Times is waiting for the invasion to be over and adapt its position to the outcome. The Washington Post, of course, did manage to work up an editorial for Sunday, which, in the usual contortionist manner, found the invasion justified but also highly risky. Press TV notes, and actually I believe Danger Room says not so fast, depleted uranium found in Gaza victims. Medics tell Press TV that they have found traces of depleted uranium in some Gaza residents wounded in Israel's ground offensive on the Strip. Norwegian medics told Press TV correspondent Akram Al-Satari that some of the victims who have been wounded since Israel began its attacks on the Gaza Strip on December 27th have traces of depleted uranium in their bodies. The report comes after Israeli tanks and troops swept across the border into Gaza last Saturday night, opening a ground operation after 8 days of intensive attacks by Israeli air and naval forces on the impoverished region. Another clip I can't play for you. Norwegian doctor in Gaza, Israel targeting civilians. Mads Gilbert, M-A-D-S, Gilbert. A Norwegian doctor working in Gaza told Sky News that the number of civilians injured and killed in Gaza proves that Israel is deliberately attacking the population. An original over on blacklistednews.com asks why Obama is silent on Gaza. If you look a few months back to when Obama was speaking at AIPAC, and of course I can hit you back to that link, January 2008, in the thrall of AIPAC, Why Obama Can't Save Us. That's now a year old. If you look back to when Obama was speaking in AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, you'll find reasons why he is silent on the current Gaza situation. As of right now, the Israeli government is invading and pillaging Gaza, and not a word from Obama. His spokesman, David Axelrod, claims that he isn't commenting because there's only one president at a time, yet that didn't stop him with nearly every other issue, such as the Mumbai attacks and the Russia-Georgia conflict. Here's why. At AIPAC in mid-2008, Obama speaks of a, quote, strong commitment to make sure that the bond between the United States and Israel is unbreakable today, tomorrow, and forever. Implying that no matter what war crimes and atrocities the government of Israel commits, the United States will run, or rather, the United States run by Obama will always lend support. We must preserve our total commitment to our unique defense relationship with Israel by fully funding military assistance and continuing work on the Arrow and related missile defense programs. There are links for you to see other great quotes from Obama's AIPAC speech showing why he ain't saying shit. Amazingly, Brian Eno, musician, producer, genius, is apparently a writer. I believe my man Jeff sent me this article that's up on counterpunch.org. Brian Eno, you know, the man behind Roxy Music and U2 and David Byrne and music for airports, for the love of God. Brian Eno weighs in. Stealing Gaza, an experiment in provocation. It's a tragedy that the Israelis, a people who must understand better than almost anybody the horrors of oppression, are now acting as oppressors. As the great Jewish writer Primo Levi once remarked, quote, everybody has their Jews, and for the Israelis, it's the Palestinians. By creating a Middle Eastern version of the Warsaw Ghetto, they are recapitulating their own history as though they've forgotten it. And by trying to paint an equivalence between the Palestinians with their homemade rockets and stone-throwing teenagers and themselves with one of the most sophisticated military machines in the world, they sacrifice all credibility. And there's more, and there are updates. Another clip I don't have time to play. First, from the BBC, Israel bombs Palestinian school, kills 30 kids and teachers. Links, of course, to the New York Times and Google News and more, some are calling it basically a full-blown humanitarian crisis at this point. However, the clip we will play, putting it on the record, from the MSM, CNN confirms Israel broke the ceasefire.
This is what is making news right now. As attacks continue, who really started it?
Israel broke the ceasefire.
But Israelis say, not true. We will fact check it fairly.
But this is important, and this is something I want to break down for the viewers. Yesterday, you and I were sitting here, and we had a conversation with Mustafa Barghouti, who's an independent legislator, Palestinian legislator. Right. And he said that most news organizations had ignored the possibility that the people who actually broke the ceasefire was not the Palestinians, not Hamas in Gaza. What he said was, in fact, I think we've got that. Dan, play this, and then we'll give you some more information. Let's go ahead and go to that.
The world press community or media community is overwhelmed with the Israeli narrative, which is incorrect. The Israeli spokesperson have been spreading lies all over. The reality and the truth is that the side that broke this truce and this ceasefire was Israel. 2 months before it ended, Israel started attacking Rafah, started attacking Khan Yunis, and never lifted the blockade on Gaza. Gaza remained without fuel, without electricity, without bread, without medications, without any medical equipment for people who were dying in Gaza. 262 people died, sick people, because of an access to medical care. So Israel broke the ceasefire.
And you know what we did? I've checked some of the folks here at our international desk, and I went to them and asked, what was he talking about? Do we have any information on that? Which they confirmed. 2 months ago, this is back in November, there was an attack. It was an Israeli raid that took out six people. Now, let me refer you. It's not just us. We checked in other periodicals. Johnny, go over my shoulder if you can. Here we go. The six-month ceasefire started coming apart at the beginning of November after Israeli commandos killed a team of Hamas fighters during a raid on a tunnel they suspected was being dug for kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. That raid set off more Palestinian rockets. That's U.S. News and World Report. I got another one for you, I believe, here. Okay, this is The Guardian. Questionable, but nonetheless. A four-month ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza was in jeopardy today. It was actually reported when it happened after Israeli troops killed six gunmen in a raid in the territory. That's important to report. And here we go as well from TheEconomist.com. And the point of contention here is this one. Johnny, one more. The last straw came in November when Israelis killed six gunmen, it said, were digging tunnels to launch a raid on Israel, spurring Hamas to respond with a barrage of rockets. So, the question is who started this? And we've been hearing that the Israelis say they had to do this because suddenly the ceasefire had been broken in Gaza by Hamas and the Palestinians. Is this now a little more in question?
That clip is a little messy, and I apologize. However, the full thing is there for you to check out. And we're going to hit another update. So there we have, first I should say, we've got CNN doing some homework and actually saying, okay, consensus is Israel started it. If we hit the London Daily News for my third update here, BBC blackout on Gaza. The London Daily News has learned there's an informal news blackout at BBC Radio over the mounting public outrage following the Gaza incursion by Israeli troops. According to sources, radio station phone-ins have been screening out any callers wanting to talk about the Israeli airstrikes and ground offensives in the Middle East. The BBC's Have Your Say comment sites are being heavily moderated. Its main board, How Can a Truce Be Achieved in Gaza, has had half of its 4,500 comments rejected on the basis of defamation, incitement to crime and hate, harassment, abuse, threats, harmful, obscene, profane, sexually oriented, homophobic, or racially offensive language. On the message board, Are the Israeli Strikes on Gaza Justified? Half of the 5,000 comments have also been removed for breaking the house rules stated above. There are links to those message boards for you. The fourth update, anti-Israeli protests continue globally. This again from Press TV and news from MiddleEast.com. The Israeli incursions into Gaza have triggered protests all over the world, with demonstrators calling for an immediate ceasefire. Public fury at the Israeli violence targeting the residents of Gaza has brought thousands of people in Turkey, Argentina, Mexico, Bolivia, Lebanon, and Austria to the streets. Lastly, we're going to take a note from an ex-IDF soldier. No, I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry, I don't have that for you right there. That's going to come when we're going to be talking about the Obama-Saya in a minute. I tricked myself there. So, it's easy to move from Israel to Pat Robertson, right? That's a quick move, hop, skip, and a jump. It's all amazing Christo-Zionist insanity. Pat Robertson predicts the U.S. will embrace socialism. Again, from Kurt Nimmo. On December 23rd, the conservative preacher Pat Robertson told CNN's Suzanne Malvo that he was pleased as punch with the election of Obama. Quote, I'm remarkably pleased with Obama. And we'll hear more of that in a minute. So, Obama's middle-of-the-road cabinet, referred to by Mr. Robertson. Obama's middle-of-the-road cabinet consists of people hailing from, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the secretive Bilderberg Group. Timothy Geithner, Obama's pick to head up the Treasury, is head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and is the Fed's main liaison with Wall Street. Obama's so-called Economic Recovery Advisory Board will be chaired by former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. Obama's outlined his geopolitical plans in Foreign Affairs, the mainstay periodical of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his wife, of course, Michelle, is a member of the CFR in Chicago. If you don't know, the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, has only one purpose, and that is world government, the push for world government. Carol Quigley the Georgetown University history professor, of course noted by Bill Clinton in his inaugural address, my mentor, Carol Quigley. Carol Quigley wrote the following, as he also was an historian for the CFR. Quote, the Council on Foreign Relations is the American branch of a society which originated in England and believes national boundaries should be obliterated and one world rule established. End quote. It would seem people like Pat Robertson have no problem with any of that. Last week, Robertson claimed to have a conversation with God, and in this revelation, Robertson makes prediction based on his supposed conversations with God at the start of the new year. The preacher was told that, quote, people will welcome socialism in order to relieve their pain. Nothing will stand in the way of a plan by Obama to restructure the economy in the same fashion as the New Deal in the 30s, which some would say would be a great thing. Obama, however, will restructure nothing, and Robertson knows it. Barack Obama is a cigar store Indian propped up to placate the people. He's window dressing for the NWO. The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes. Quote, from Felix Frankfurter, Justice of the Supreme Court. He told FDR, the man credited with the first New Deal. The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes. Justice of the Supreme Court, Felix Frankfurter. The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the large centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson. Obama's stacked his administration with representatives from these financial elements. Pat Robertson knows this. He wrote a book called New World Order. In the book, he stated that Colonel Edward M. House, Edward Mandel House, along with other internationalists, realized that America would not embrace world government without a change in public opinion. Two clips from the prophetic Pat Robertson, one from CNN and one from the pulpit. Pat Robertson predicts the U.S. will embrace socialism.
Do you think that the president now is handling it correctly with all of this bailout money, these loans to some of these private industries and these banks?
Suzanne, I frankly think that this TARP has been mishandled, mismanaged. I am not at all pleased with the way they've done it. I know they needed a rescue, but they pulled a number out of a hat, $700 billion. They didn't know exactly what they needed, and they haven't spent it helping the consumers, helping homeowners. It's all gone into shore up the balance sheet of the banks, and the banks aren't lending. So I don't think it was well done.
Who do you think actually dropped the ball? Do you think it was the president, the administration, or perhaps the automakers, the banks? Do you blame anyone in particular?
Well, it's hard to assess blame, but over the years, I hate to be critical, because I mean, I am a Republican, and this is, you know, the president of the party that I'm a member of. But I think we've had some serious goofs along the way. The Katrina matter was terrible. The rebuilding of Iraq has been terrible. The handling of the economy right now has been terrible. It hasn't been handled in what I would consider a professional manner.
How would you grade the president in light of all of the laundry list that you just listed there?
Well, you know, history may accord him a higher grade than his contemporaries, and I think he's hoping for that, and we are, but I believe I would look at about a C- right now if I were grading him.
Are you looking forward to an Obama administration? A change.
You know, I am remarkably pleased with Obama. I had grave misgivings about him, but so help me, he's come in forcefully, intelligently. He's picked a middle-of-the-road cabinet, and so far, if he continues down this course, he has the makings of a great president. So I'm very pleased so far.
So here are some of the things that I feel are going to be happening in 2009. The Lord said the economy of your nation will recover. The steps taken will lead to a dramatic increase in the power of government. People will welcome socialism in order to relieve their pain. Nothing will stand in the way of a plan by Obama to restructure the economy in the same fashion as the New Deal of the 30s. America will never again have the power in the world that it has enjoyed since World War II. With no strong leadership, dangerous dictators will arise in various parts of the world that will threaten the peace and security of millions of people. Russia will be the most dangerous and will lead the coalition to control the Middle East. Israel is entering a period of extreme crisis. A strong government that deals forcefully with the Palestinians will bring international condemnation and sanctions against Israel. But the Lord will uphold his people despite world opinion.
Prophecies and predictions gleaned through conversations with God held by Mr. Pat Robertson. I guess I missed his predictions for 2008. However, I do have the flashback link at the bottom for his predictions for 2007 posted up January 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com. Pat Robertson predicts mass killing. Which now, of course, brings us to the first of two massive postings on the very soon-to-be-anointed Obamasiah. First, it's presidential puppets, the CIA, the CFR cabinet, and a new world order. First, Bush-Obama meet with all those other ex-puppets.
Pictures worth a thousand words. There they are. Our resplendent presidents, future and past and current.
For joining the ex-presidents for lunch, one message that I have, and I think we all share, is that we want you to succeed. Whether we're Democrat or Republican, we care deeply about this country. And to the extent we can, we look forward to sharing our experiences with you. All of us who have served in this office understand that the office itself transcends the individual. And we wish you all the very best. And so does the country.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Thank you.
I just want to thank the president. I just want to thank the president for hosting us. This is an extraordinary gathering. All the gentlemen here understand both the pressures and possibilities of this office. And for me to have the opportunity to get advice, good counsel, and fellowship with these individuals is extraordinary. And I'm very grateful to all of them. But again, thank you, Mr. President, for hosting us.
Okay, guys.
From their successes.
Thank you. Let's go, guys.
You need help?
I love this rug.
Good to see you. How are you?
I love this rug. I hadn't caught that before from Billy. So there's a nice little dog and pony show photo op, grip and grin bullshit of the ex-puppets. Of course, that got tons of ink. You got the AP and the DPA. Obama has extraordinary lunch with current and former presidents. One from the AP again, Obama's Kenyan step-grandmother to attend the inaugural ball. Granny, as she's known. So she's coming over for the inauguration. Maybe she'll do some interviews and she can talk about being there when Obama was born. Wherever that may have been. Again from Kurt Nemo, again and again from the murderous Heinz Kissinger. You know him as Henry Kissinger. Kissinger calls for a new world order. Again and again and again. In the clip here, he repeats the corporate media lie about Hamas and the Palestinians. In 1988, according to the Washington Post, Kissinger, quote, recommended at a private gathering recently that Israel prohibit television reporters and cameras from the violence-torn occupied territories and that the Palestinian uprisings be, quote, brutally and rapidly suppressed. According to a memo paraphrasing his remarks, the memo said Kissinger emphasized repeatedly that under no circumstances should Israel make concessions during the current period of violence. That was back in 88. That was then. But what now happens and what really rankles in this clip that we're about to hear is Kissinger's call for Obama to create a new world order.
What do you think the most important thing is for Barack Obama? Obviously, you're here to talk about the anniversary for U.S.-China diplomatic relations, but if you had to say this is going to be the country or the conflict or the place that will define the Obama administration, what would it be?
The president elect is coming to office at a moment when there are upheavals in many parts of the world simultaneously. You have India, Pakistan, the jihadist movement. So he can't really say that it's one problem, that it's the most important one. But he can give a new impetus to American foreign policy, partly because the reception of him is so extraordinary around the world. I think his task will be to develop an overall strategy for America in this period when really a new world order can be created. It's a great opportunity. It isn't just a crisis.
So, of course, you can hit my flashbacks to, again, January of 2007, where Kissinger calls for a new world order. And originally, back in September 2006, was the first time Kissinger and the new world order were mentioned on MediaMonarchy.com. And, of course, I'd just like to mention, I hope, of course, that sometime in the near future, Henry Kissinger's next flight will be diverted to places like Chile, where he can be held for war crimes. And it's not just Kissinger. And it's not just the Wall Street Journal throwing out now the term New World Order. Even guys like John King of CNN. The video's up there. Of course, Viacom smashes it anytime it pops up on YouTube. But John King on the Colbert Report just a few days ago noted that Obama was, quote, in for a New World Order. Of course, he mentions his New World Order after Colbert jokes about the media's role in getting Obama elected. So, gee, why do they keep using that term? And in reference to Obama and his agenda, no less, I thought the New World Order agenda supposedly didn't exist. And I noticed some commenters noted that John King's use of Obama in for a New World Order almost seemed strained, like he wanted to insert it somewhere and that was the best spot. Side notes, of course, on the Chicago corruption operation board games, of course, connects Obama to Resco, to Auchi, to Al-Samari, and on over to Blagojevich and all the rest. Leadership denies Burris, Roland Burris, a seat in the Senate, so that is raging on as they've been swearing in all the new Congress critters. Leadership denies Roland Burris a seat in the Senate. That's from WRAL.com. However, again, from Danger Room and many other places, such as the New York Times and Raw Story and Raw Replay, spooks scratch their noggins over Obama's CIA pick. The incoming Obama administration has named Leon Panetta, of all people, as its nominee for the Director of Central Intelligence, DCI. Some observers are confused, to put it mildly, about the pick. The guy, Leon Panetta, a former White House Chief of Staff and House Budget Committee Chairman, has a reputation for being a tough, competent manager, they say, but can he really be an effective CIA chief with experience in the cloak and dagger world? What about those pledges to keep the intelligence community out of politics? I find the choice of Leon Panetta to head the CIA a curious one, one well-connected former spook tells Danger Room. On the one hand, if you're looking to pick a nation's top spook, it's generally a good idea to pick someone with more than a cursory exposure to the intel business. It's also more than a little annoying that we can't seem to find a CIA chief that hasn't spent all their adult life playing politics. However, another clip I don't have time to play. It's all too much and overwhelming to keep up with, but our favorite ex-CIA agent, Bob Baer, says that Leon Panetta is a good pick for the CIA. That said on the Rachel Maddow Show on the Microsoft General Electric Network. However, yet again, another Council on Foreign Relations member has been appointed to the Obama-sized coming criminal cabinet. Obama selects another CFR member, CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta, to be the Surgeon General. America's most famous television surgeon, Sanjay Gupta, is poised to take his black bag and microphone to the White House as President-elect Barack Obama's choice for U.S. Surgeon General, reports the Washington Post. A neurosurgeon who's also a correspondent for CNN and CBS, Gupta was chosen as much for his broadcasting skills as for his medical resume, suggesting that the incoming administration values visible advisors who can drive a public message. Gupta was not only chosen for his broadcasting skills, but also because he's a trusted insider. Not surprisingly, Dr. Sanjay Gupta is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Part of Gupta's public message is that thimerosal and its mercury-based preservatives have nothing to do with autism. In 2007, Gupta went on CNN to state there appears to be no relationship between thimerosal and autism. Watch the video. Gupta does not mention a study published in the March 10, 2006 issue of American Physicians and Surgeons that reveals that since mercury was removed from childhood vaccines, the alarming increase in reported rates of autism and other neurological disorders in children dropped sharply. Independent researchers used the government's own databases on childhood neurological disorders, including autism, before and after removal of mercury-based preservatives. Mr. Gupta appears to be part of an effort to deny there's an epidemic and try to hide the data from public scrutiny, while at the same time secretly putting in an addendum to the Homeland Security Act specifically to prevent parents from suing vaccine companies for vaccine damage. You can link and hit the Autism Mercury Link archive page on autismcoach.com. Sanjay Gupta, as a member of the CFR and the Mockingbird corporate media, is part of the ongoing eugenics vaccination effort, thus his appointment as Surgeon General makes perfect sense. In addition, he was a White House fellow in 1997 and served as special advisor to then First Lady Hillary Clinton. We're told that the pitch to him has been that health care reform will be a top priority, that wellness, fitness, obesity, and the issues he has focused on often here at CNN will be a top priority. That reporting from the, just a moment ago, New World Order mentioning CNN's John King. So, in other words, Dr. Sanjay Gupta will be Obama's point man on the, quote, continuum of care, basically from birth to death, end quote, as fellow Council on Foreign Relations member John Edwards put it, that is to say, government micromanagement of wellness, fitness, obesity, and other health issues. So chalk up another member of the Council on Foreign Relations to the coming criminal cabinet of the Obama-siah. This is the clip now that I thought I had earlier for you, because I figured I had it under the ground assault Israeli slaughter post. However, this concerns Mr. Obama. A former Israel Defense Force captain says that Obama will act as a, quote, slave to Israel and AIPAC.
I'm very sad to say that if Obama will go into the White House and continue to act like a slave and not like a leader, I don't see a change coming. If he continues to play golf and act like a slave forced by AIPAC or any other interests and lobbyists in Washington, and if he continues to not to talk about the horrible crime that's happening in my country now, I don't see any change coming to the world.
I have no idea how the government reacts to what you say on international media like this, but what do you say to those accusations that there will be, that you're a traitor, in effect, to Israel, that you're showing treachery, perhaps treason, in voicing the view that you've just voiced?
I risked my life for many years as a captain and an operation leader of operations in the Israeli Air Force. I worked with Israeli terror victims for many years. I know from a very close distance the pain of the Israeli people as well the Palestinian people. So no one can call me or the thousands of members of the anti-occupation movement in Israel that we are traitors. On the contrary, we are patriots. We want our people to continue to exist, and we see our leaders' actions as a self-destruction policies that puts in a great danger the future of all of us. And we want to simply, as I'm telling it to you, as a rescue pilot, as a former rescue pilot in the Israeli Air Force, this is the most important rescue mission I can take upon myself to save the people here, whether they are Israelis, Palestinians, Jews, Muslims, Christians. And we all know that the situation in the Middle East affects the whole world. And it could be as easy as that, that this kind of conflict can escalate to a world war. Don't forget the forces in the other places in the Middle East, the tension between Iran and the United States, other countries. We are in a great danger now, and if people want to help me as an Israeli and as a Jew, they have to put massive pressure on the Israeli government for ceasefire right now. Right now, we need a ceasefire. We need to be forced to sit and negotiate with Hamas. We have no other legitimate action but sitting and negotiating now with Hamas and with the Arab world. Don't forget that we have the Arab Initiative. For many years by now, Arab Initiative say that they offer complete peace and normalization if Israel withdraw to the 1967 borders. As an Israeli, this is my interest, to have peace with the Palestinians and all the Arab world, and my government ignore this request for many years.
All right.
So this is my request.
Yonatan Shapira, thank you very much indeed for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, that's on the BBC, and you noticed as soon as he mentioned going back to the 1967 borders, okay, interview over, you're cut. That whole video is up there where that former IDF captain fears that Obama may act as a, quote, slave to Israel and AIPAC. Last couple notes on this first Obama Saya heading, with just a headline for you from the Associated Press, just a little boogie-boogie to get you going as we get close to the inauguration. Feds say inauguration, an attractive terrorist target. But they won't say who or what or nothing specific, just a little scaranoia for you. If we move to the Village Voice, who, actually, they would deserve a bailout. I believe the Village Voice is struggling financially, so we should give the Village Voice a bailout before we give Larry Flint and Joe Francis a bailout. But I digress. Obama and the Black Widow super spy computer. I notice, too, now, sidebar note, the unfortunate, and it's, I don't believe that it is, but how you can sometimes now perceive this sort of the racial language and the words and things. So, of course, it was probably no mistake that the previous clip we just heard used the word slave. And now, when you see Black Widow, in reference to the name of the new NSA supercomputer that will soon be under the controls of Obama, I just wanted to make the note that, of course, it's not lost on me that you see these words there. Obama and the Black Widow super spy computer. And of course, others have noted things like Michelle Obama's dress on election day, I believe in the evening, the Black Widow dress that she wore. So that just the sort of semiology around this. Digressing again from the Village Voice, Barack Obama will be in charge of the biggest domestic and international spying operation in history. Its prime engine is the National Security Agency, the NSA, no such agency, located and guarded, of course, at Fort Meade in Maryland, about 10 miles northeast of Washington, D.C. A brief glimpse of its ever-expanding capacity was provided on October 26th by the Baltimore Sun's national security correspondent David Wood, with a link and a quote, quote, the NSA's colossal Cray, C-R-A-Y. The NSA's colossal Cray supercomputer, codenamed the Black Widow, scans millions of domestic and international phone calls and emails every hour. The Black Widow, performing hundreds of trillions of calculations per second, searches through and reassembles keywords and patterns across many languages. There are links in there to Adventures in Daily Living, a small blog where they notice this foreshadowing from Michelle Obama's black dress. However, more importantly, the link to the BaltimoreSun.com and their October 26th report about the new, or the latest, or the newest, that they're telling us about, NSA super spying computer. That's the first one. Now the second one, Obama Saya, China, the Masonic inaugural ball, and of course, civilian service. first from Bloomberg. Obama moves to counter China by linking up the Pentagon and NASA. President-elect Barack Obama will probably tear down long-standing barriers between the U.S.'s civilian and military space programs, you know, to speed up a mission to the moon amid the prospect of a new space race with China. Obama's transition team is considering a collaboration between the Defense Department and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration because military rockets may be cheaper and ready sooner than the space agency's planned launch vehicle, which isn't slated to fly until 2015, according to people who've discussed the idea with the Obama team. The potential change comes as Pentagon concerns are rising over China's space ambitions because of what is perceived as an eventual threat to U.S. defense satellite, the lofty battlefield eyes of the military. The Obama administration will have all those issues on the table, said Neil Lane, who served as Bubba Clinton's science advisor and wrote recently that Obama must make early decisions critical to retaining U.S. space dominance. That's space wars. Quote, the foreign affairs and national security implications have to be considered. That's more from ZDNet as well as CNET and all the nets you can handle. Hilariously, interestingly enough, the flyer is posted up for you. You can check it out. The first ever Masonic inaugural ball is being held for Obama. This by way of Aftermath News. William R. Singleton Hope Lebanon Lodge number 7, which you can hit up at singletonlodge.org. William R. Singleton Hope Lebanon Lodge number 7 is hosting the first ever Masonic inaugural ball in honor of President-elect Barack Obama and Vice President-elect Joseph Biden. Tickets are limited, so you're encouraged to purchase yours quickly. This first ever event will be held at 8 p.m. on January 20th at the Stars Bistro at 2120 P Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. While other inaugural balls are costing $125 to $500 or more per ticket, we've arranged for an evening with some amazing food, a great DJ, and brotherhood. All for $65 per ticket. We've also included an incentive to help pay the babysitter. Couples may go for just a $120 apiece. All proceeds from this event will be donated to the Masonic Foundation of the District of Columbia. For more information or tickets, go to singletonlodge.org. The first ever Masonic inaugural ball for the Obamasiah, of course. Now, there are more links and more updates from places like dailynewscaster.com and flashback links to Media Monarchy. And that's, of course, Rahm Emanuel and Obama and the plan for mandatory civil service, which, of course, once the fake economy collapses, you won't have any other job but to be a snitch for the state. Almost like it was planned that way. You can, of course, hit up the flashback link a year ago, HR 393. You can hit up govtrack.us, Universal National Service Act of 2007. House Resolution 393. Lastly, thank God on this note, I'm sure there'll be more updates. I'm sure there'll be more ups and downs with the coming criminal cabinet. However, Bill Richardson withdraws from his nomination to the criminal cabinet. This from the Deutsche Press Agentur. Bill Richardson has been tapped, or rather had been tapped, by President-elect Barack Obama to serve as Commerce Secretary in the incoming U.S. administration. But last Sunday, the New Mexico governor surprisingly withdrew his name from consideration for the position. Richardson cited an investigation of a company that had done business with New Mexico's government as grounds for the move. He did not provide details of the investigation except to say that he and his administration, quote, have acted properly in all matters. He said the probe would likely last for several weeks or months and would hamper his confirmation by the U.S. Senate. You can get more from the Washington Post on the rise and fall of Richardson as Commerce Secretary. However, our man, Greg Palast, fine investigative journalist, published well overseas and, of course, I was going to make the joke, you know, couldn't get arrested in the States, but of course, There was a warrant out for his arrest by Homeland Security for photographing critical infrastructure in New Orleans when he was, you know, videoing the toxic trailers next to horrible power plants and environmental degradation. Bill Richardson, Kissinger American. From GregPalast.com, Bill Richardson is out, caught with his hand, if not exactly in the cookie jar, at least you could say his sticky fingers were near it, and I'm not surprised. For years, writes Greg Palast, for years I've been investigating the second most corrupt state in the USA after Alaska. I like to check in on the Enchanted State. I knew it was not a polite question, but it was really bugging me, so he asks his friend Santiago Juarez, exactly how does a Mexican get the name William Richardson? Governor Richardson's dad, Santiago explained, was a Citibank executive assigned to Mexico City. There he met Governor Bill's mom and Milagro, a Mexican-American, was born. Richardson gets big mileage out of his mother's heritage, and that makes him legitimately a Mexican-American, a politically useful designation, but it's just as legitimate to say that Richardson is a Citibank American. But, of course, Governor Richardson is much more than that. Between leaving Bill Clinton's cabinet, where he was Secretary of Energy, and grabbing a Hispanic district seat in Congress, Richardson became a partner in Kissinger and Associates. That would make Richardson a Kissinger American as well. In 2004, John Kerry won New Mexico, if you, you know, counted the votes, but they didn't, and Bush won the state and the presidency by 5,000 votes. Everybody was talking about the theft of Ohio by the Republicans, but few noted that New Mexico was stolen as well. One fact drove me nuts. In the end, this state and its damaged elections were in the hands of Richardson, a Democrat, and a Mexican-American at that. In Mexico, the issue of uncounted votes is more than skin deep. Lots of Mexican-American votes don't tally, but the Citibank American votes never get lost. Kissinger American votes always count. The story of America's failed elections is not about undervotes, it's about underclass. Disenfranchisement is class warfare by other means. It just so happens that in New Mexico, the colors of the underclass are, for the most part, brown and red. Greg Palast goes on to talk about class war by other means, and of course, we've noted that folks like Webster Tarpley are saying what is going on is going to be class war again. They'll try and sell you that, you know, class is dead and kumbaya. That is actually an excerpt from Armed Madhouse by Greg Palast. So, of course, that notes pretty well that he has been tracking Bill Richardson as Kissinger American. So, basically, it's interesting to note that Richardson dropped out to be... Basically, he didn't want to go through the confirmation process, but he dropped out of being the Commerce Secretary because he didn't want to disclose all the shit. And then when you find out that he's associated with Henry Kissinger, who does the same thing. Heinz Kissinger, the first appointee to the 9/11 Commission, the Kane-Hamilton whitewash. If you recall, before it was Kane and Hamilton, it was Henry Kissinger. When he met with Patty Casaza and Lori Van Auken and some of the other Jersey girls, victims' families from 9/11, they asked him to disclose his client list of Kissinger associates. They say he nearly spilled his coffee and coughed. He soon dropped out. He and folks like him can't stand the scrutiny. It won't be able to stand up. So, thanks to Greg Palast for pointing out Bill Richardson, Kissinger, American. Some of the things we're probably not going to have time now to go over. We'll hit them in the next B-side. However, just to whet your appetite, those are going to be some media memes. And that, of course, is the, I think, strange death of Scientologist John Travolta's son, who died from a, quote, medical episode while on vacation in the Bahamas, and it brings up all the disturbing questions about Scientology, about psychology, about the disease industry, and medicine, and cults, and all of that. So there's interesting connections to Dianetics, drugs, and the death of a young Travolta. There's another one from Bill Moyers, talking about the great Marx Brothers film Duck Soup and how it is so appropriate for today. There's also a video and a report from the Ashland Daily Tidings about the Oregon Art Gallery hosting the Bush shoe toss. That has a clip that's not very interesting to listen to. It's mostly people throwing boots at nice, awesome paintings of George Bush. And that's going on in Ashland, Oregon, but that got picked up, actually, by Raw Story and Raw Replay and other places. From the UPI, there's a long, ugly list of world events that fell through the cracks in U.S. media, so think of it basically as UPI's version of this sort of Project Censored. There's also a good video called How to Stop the New World Order, mainly a compilation piece, and the last bit would be the Philly Mall that now boasts a new Army Recruitment Arcade. At the Franklin Mills Mall in Pennsylvania, you can go to the Army Experience Center. But we're not going to have time. We're going to have to go through those in more detail on the B-side 106 of MediaMonarchy.com. As we glance to Google News quickly, Illinois House votes to impeach Governor Blagojevich. This from the New York Times. Illinois House of Reps voted overwhelmingly to impeach Governor Rod R. Blagojevich on Friday on the grounds of abuse of power as the state's chief executive. 30 confirmed dead in shelling of Gaza family. That from the New York Times as well, and I'm sure it's much uglier than that as it's going to go on. And from Bloomberg, 2008 payrolls drop biggest since 1945. Many years ago. So we hit, of course, at the beginning in the econo crash heading, that job losses to a 63-year high, manufacturing to a 28-year low, and on and on. And who, as we've been saying, have been saying things like this were going to happen, not people like prize-winning economists like Paul Krugman. It's been people like Ron Paul and Peter Schiff and Tlaib and Jim Rogers and Bob Chapman and other economists that, you know, they can squeak in on CNBC or some after-hours cable network, but they don't get the major ink that the shills do. And the shills are telling you, we need to do more of the same. We need to print more money. So as we noted from the top of the show, it was how we ended the B-side of 105. It was how we started this episode 106. Of course, that we're spending trillions to maintain a crumbling empire. Let's quickly go through the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had das.state.or.us, State of Oregon, out of Salem, Oregon, Googled Oregon taxing by the mile. Of course, trying again and again to bring up the GPS satellite tracking of your car to track your mileage in Oregon. And it'll all tie in to your carbon fucking footprint. Carbon tax, world tax, global tax, enviro snitches. It's coming very soon. All we need are more environmental catastrophes like we had last week in Tennessee and the Tennessee Valley Authority, and hundreds of millions of gallons of sludge and ash. Or, as I've noted before, what happened in the Simpsons movie where, oops, there was a man-made environmental catastrophe, so FEMA and the EPA have to quarantine your city, and then when we don't know what to do with it, we're going to blow it up and sell it as the new Grand Canyon, and we'll bring in Tom Hanks to sell it to you. But I digress. Again, Department of Homeland Security from Springfield, Virginia, they Googled something that didn't exactly make sense to me. Of course, as you throw, the more words you throw into a search, the better I'm going to do, because I have lots of different words on MediaMonarchy.com. They may not be exactly what you were looking for, but one word here and the other word there will still get you to MediaMonarchy.com. Homeland Security Googled Juan Stewart sentenced to 60 months in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. for narcotics in 2008. I believe because I have mentions of John Stewart and all those other things on my site that they picked it up. Good job, Homeland Security. Drug Enforcement Agency or Administration visiting, of course, Fort Jackson, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Army headquarters, officers blamed for Tillman case errors. Hilton Hospitality out of Memphis, Tennessee, Googled Edward Casey, JFK, and Oswald predictions. I believe they meant Edgar Casey, the soothsayer, the sleeping prophet. But they got here anyway. Electronic Arts, the video game place out of Redwood, California. We had MIG Incorporated, MIG out of Eugene, Oregon. We also had SOMOS out of Costa Mesa, California. They Googled Ron Paul Big Trouble. So interesting new companies I haven't seen before visiting Media Monarchy. General Electric out of Fairfield, Connecticut, Googled SAIC, FEMA, Mount Weather. And you should too. The National Park Service out of Aurora, Colorado visited, as well as the aforementioned, as I hit in the first hour, the Central Intelligence Agency visiting the website to comment on a post. And I could track them back from their visit to the site, and I posted that up for you. So, again, thanks to the CIA for pointing out the slight inconsistency in the terror anthrax counterterrorism calendar. We also had the National Institutes of Health. They were reading about the National Counterterrorism Center's massive free downloadable PDF counterterrorism calendar that's linked up for you. We also had Coast to Coast Medical out of Fall River, Massachusetts, Google Rex 84, PNAC, and finally Penn Mutual Life Insurance out of Horsham, Pennsylvania, Googled Bluebeam Project. And I'm proud to say that the stories that we went over now several weeks ago on MediaMonarchy.com, Project Bluebeam, TV fakery, holographic projections, and audio spotlights, is now becoming one of the more definitive hits that you'll get if you Google Project Bluebeam. Of course, the idea that they're going to fake some sort of bullshit Orson Welles alien invasion, or more sinisterly, create and fake some sort of religious event, whether you want to see Jesus or whether you want to see your favorite deity, the military technology is somewhat there. Could they pull off a fake rapture alien invasion hoax? I believe they could. And that's where we're going to leave it on episode 106, January 9th, 2009 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. I thank you and love you for listening to the show on the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network and KBFR in Boulder, Colorado, 93.9. Thank you, guys. Please get in touch with me. Send me an email, MediaMonarchy@Yahoo.com, and we'll keep getting through it, and we'll keep trying to make sense of the wicked puzzle that we see in front of us. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.